In an ever-changing world, we need to keep track of what will be next. Forward Thinkers is your 48 Forward podcast to discover the future. We are talking to innovative and creative minds from all over the world to learn more about what they are working on and what they think will change the way we work and live within the next decade. Are you ready to join the ride? Welcome to Forward Thinkers.
So welcome to Munich.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me. And thank you for coming on this cold, dark morning, Monday morning. I am not the best person to start this, perhaps. Now you're regretting it already.
Yeah, we start with depressive thoughts and then we are getting better and better over the day, hopefully. Let's try.
I am the low point then.
Nah, not really. We are like the reality check. Let's put it that way.
Sure.
Yeah, I already mentioned your book, How to Lose a Country. Why did you write it?
First of all, I don't believe in this optimism-pessimism thing. I think it is quite limiting, and it doesn't make a difference if you're an optimist or pessimist. I think it's more important to assess the reality and focus on what you have to do as a person or as a community. And why I wrote this is very much related to this. Because I left my country in 2016. I'm from Turkey. So you might already imagine why I left the country. I was a columnist and, you know, things got harder and harder. And at some point, my life has become like many others' lives. Like, are they going to get me at 5 o'clock in the morning? What should I wear when I'm going to bed? Because, you know, fascism is a funny thing. They don't only imprison you, but also depending on your nightwear choices, it can embarrass you as well at 5 o'clock. So I became so obsessed with this thought and I realized that I am doing nothing intellectually anymore. Another funny side of fascism is that even if you're against it, it dumbs you down because your whole job becomes saying no to something every day, every moment. So this is why I left. And as soon as I left, when I moved to Zagreb, I realized that what had been happening in Turkey was actually repeating itself in European countries and in United States. So a little bit naively, perhaps, and maybe we talk about that later, I thought if I could tell them what will happen in Europe and in the United States, if I can warn them, perhaps they will gather themselves and realize that this is a global issue. It is not unique to Turkey or India or all those crazy countries. It's coming for everyone. Then maybe they could start working on it. So this is why I wrote together. I started writing it in 2017. It came out 2019. And by then, I thought everybody knew what was happening. But then, unfortunately, there's this thing called Western exceptionalism. And they really deeply believe in Western Europe and especially in the United States that, you know, this is a thing, fascism is a thing that happened in those countries where democracy is not mature enough. We have mature democracies, we have strong institutions, so it cannot happen to us. Here's a fun fact. When it was published in 2019, How to Lose a Country had a subtitle. It was Seven Steps from Democracy to Dictatorship. It has been published in more than 12 languages. And in each country, I try to, you know, convince the editors that we should make the subtitle Seven Steps from Democracy to Fascism. None of the European or American editors accepted this. Because they thought, what fascism? What are you talking about? Like, it's passé. It's so Second World War. And last year, the book made several republications in every country almost. And all my editors, especially in United States and America, they wanted me to change the title to fascism. So we did. So I think this tells enough already that where we are, unfortunately, a little bit late. I wrote it to the main reason I wrote this book, and which is still important, I think. Confusion on a massive scale is a tool for the new kind of fascism. It is created through social media. It is created through the narrative of leaders. It's created through, you know, now AI. So I wanted to clear the mess, so to speak. I wanted to lay out the logic, the mechanism of new fascism, so that people can see it clearly without all the confusion, so that they can understand. I kind of reversed engineered the current state of fascism, current form of fascism, so that people can understand. I'm going on and on. You don't interrupt me, so I'm going on. Because I thought when people understood, and this is the naive part, when people understood what is happening, they could have reacted properly. What I didn't know then, understanding or knowing or realizing are not enough. We have to do something else.
Yeah, I think what I learned over the last couple of years is, first of all, democracy doesn't die on a single day or a single month or a single year. It's a slow shift. And the shift is so slow that most of the people that are not working with those topics every day hardly can feel it. But it's, if you look back at, if you would do like a reality check, go back like 15 years and try to understand what was possible to say back then, in like what felt okay and what feels okay now. And if you would just do like 10 minutes of what Trump is saying and put it back 15 years ago and let people listen to that, they would be shocked. But nowadays, nobody is really shocked anymore. And at the same time, we see a devaluation of words. If we look at, again, Trump, he was even joking about being called a fascist last week, like dragging the value of that word down as it would be like something like a clown or whatever. And everything kind of becomes normal. And I think that's the real danger, because people are like, you know, they are not afraid of those words anymore. They are not seeing what is actually happening. And I think we are not feeling enough pain yet to actually act, because in our very personal view, as like, you know, a Western European, more or less good situated, having a job, whatever, there is no pain yet. And I think that's the big issue. When I was younger, I was always okay. Nah, it will never happen, because we saw what would happen if it happens, and we will never do that again, because we all learned it at school and we all have like a strong opinion on it. But we don't really see what is happening because we don't feel it yet.
There are so many things in what you said. Where shall I pick it up from? We don't feel it, or you don't feel it, or anybody in this room might not feel it personally, because we are, you know, all these topics, democracy, fighting against fascism, they are most, can we just stop the smoke, by the way? It's kind of choking me. There's already smoke in the air, I mean, like politically, so. We are not affected yet, because democracy, losing democracy is mostly about minorities. They feel that there is some change. Women feel it. Minorities, immigrants, black people, or LGBTQ, those people who protested for Gaza, they feel it. But, you know, there's always a way to kind of protect yourself if you are in the cultural elite, if you're in the political elite, if you're in the corporate elite, of course. Many people all around the world, as you might have already know, when they're talking about Trump, for instance, they are drawing similarities with Hitler. I find this intellectually lazy and a little bit absurd. Because it means that you are not assessing the current reality, you're just drawing this very abrupt, very blunt similarity. But if we really want to draw similarities with the history, we should go back to 1920s, actually. What happened in 1920s created Hitler. What happened in 1980s actually created Trump. So what happened then was a crisis of economics, a crisis of democracy, a political crisis rather, and that crisis created these people, these leaders, and these movements. And that crisis not only created these leaders, but also they created a mess of people who thought that politics is corrupt. Since 1980s, especially, we have been made to think or believe that politics is corrupt, politicians are corrupt, and politics is happening elsewhere, not in our lives. As far as I know, in this room, there are people from corporate world, there are people from army, there are people from media, there are students. And imagine now that all these people, army says that we are, you know, out of politics. Journalists say that we are objective, or rather neutral. We are out of politics. Corporate world, I mean, like most of it is corporate world. They really believe that politics happening elsewhere. Corporate world is business that is like sterile. That's only business and strictly business. So politics cannot enter. Students think that they are not included in politics anyway, so they are not interested. So who is going to do the politics then? So what is politics? Politics is exactly what you said. You know, this, you said that let's take the 15 years and see what has been normalized in these 15 years. Politics is happening in our lives, in our daily lives. Politics happens when we don't say anything, when a taxi driver tells us that immigrants should be ousted, should be, you know, sent back to their countries. When you say, ah, let's not talk about politics. Politics happens exactly when you say, let's not talk about politics. So, and many people think that this is the tragic part of it. Many people think that this is their individual stance, individual thought, idea. No, it's not. It has been imposed in our heads since 1980s when Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher told us that there is no alternative, meaning that there is no ideological alternative. We came to the end of ideology. Now we are going to live in a world without ideology. And so on. In many countries, including mine, and perhaps in this country as well, ideology itself, the word itself, became a dirty word. It is something you shouldn't have. But then, if you don't have an ideology, if you don't have a political stance, if you don't have a political view of the world, I can assure you, others will. And they will come to you, or they will go to people saying that politics is corrupt and I am beyond and above politics and I'm going to clean up this mess, drain this swamp, and I'm going to be the good leader. I'm going to be the strong man. And this is the first chapter of How to Lose a Country. All these leaders, all these movements come to power by saying that they are not political. They are above and beyond politics. So they are clean. So I wanted to give you very rough, very brief historical background of how we came here to think that we don't have to do politics. We are not political animals. And as for United States, perhaps a note, which is a little bit related to Germany as well. You know, we can compare that. Trump you know, all these leaders, and this is my what my book is about, How to Lose a Country. There are patterns, and these patterns are followed by each leader, each movement that has that have fascist inclinations. And these patterns are exactly the same, even though the countries are completely different from each other. However, what Trump does is so interesting because this is the first time the speed is used as a tool. It took Tayyip Erdogan, Turkish president, to do what Trump had done in 100 days, 15 years. Trump managed in, you know, few months even, what Tayyip Erdogan done in 15 years. So speed, this slapping speed, this shocking speed that leave people paralyzed became a tool. So we, from now on, we can expect that such speed can be used as a tool in European countries as well. Comparing Germany is interesting because, yes, as you said, this is happening very slowly in this country. So we don't feel it. I've been living in Germany for the since 2023. I lived in Hamburg 1.5 years and now almost 2 years, more than 2 years in Berlin. I like Berlin better, by the way, if you want to know. What shocks me in Germany, not shocks me, but it is interesting. I find it a little bit sweet, but also painful to watch. German people in general, they cannot imagine that rules can be broken. They still cannot imagine that institutions crumble. It's an amazing thing. You know, it's lovely. Seriously, because seeing that kind of trust in institutions is so, I don't know, it's a privilege. But then we are faced with a global phenomenon, which I call fascism, that can corrupt everything, that can crumble everything, and our abstract trust in institutions can come to nothing. It might not happen tomorrow afternoon, like it happened in the United States, but it can happen. And what is more painful to watch in Germany is that due to this abstract trust in institutions, people have this confidence in courts and in state apparatus to stop the right-wing extremism. What do you trust in when it comes to stopping AfD? Courts and state surveillance. I hope I'm not wrong about this. I mean, like, let me know if, please correct me if I'm wrong. But this is what they trust in. They don't trust in themselves and they don't trust political mechanisms. So this is terrifying for me. It is painful to watch because I know how it happens in every country and in my country as well. You trust in these institutions and you forget that all institutions, including army, including courts, they are political machines as well. And we already know that the mainstream centrist politics that we so depend on is leaking as well. And, you know, mainstream centrist politics is trying to make itself more like AfD to get votes. So why do you think courts are immune? Why do you think that all these institutions that are, you know, described as being about politics immune to this? They are made of people. And these people naturally have political stances. These people naturally have anger or pain or, I don't know, confusions. So perhaps we might want to focus on what we can do politically if all these institutions that we depend on, you know, are not strong enough.
Yeah. And we saw what happens if you trust in those institutions in the US right now. It's not really working that well.
Some of my friends in Washington, after a few weeks Trump came to power, told me that Washington is full of zombies now. People were literally walking like zombies in Washington because there was this, people were sacked from their work, state institutions were dismissed and so on. And they didn't know what to do because they don't have unions. They don't have they are not politically organized. And they thought that centers, politics, or Democrats will save them. Nothing happened. And it was zombies looking at each other, thinking, like, what are we doing now? So they lost their political practice, so they couldn't react. I don't think that will happen in Europe, because European countries, especially Western European countries, are politically organized one way or another, at least better than the United States. But this is not the guarantee that it won't happen here. And when it happens, you don't know it by yourself, not perhaps people in this room. You just watch it from a distance happening to other people that you don't really necessarily like. But if it happens to them, 100% guarantee it will come to you as well. Even if it doesn't come to you, other people's dignity is broken, and dignity is one thing that brings us together. If other people's dignity is broken, your dignity is a little bit broken as well. Even if you are not personally directly affected by what's happening.
So maybe to hopefully end with some more optimistic thoughts, do you think we still have ways to kind of turn this whole development back? Especially if you look at Germany, for example, with an election coming up in 2029, or even before that, we will see how this coalition is working out. But do you see a way how we can prevent a AfD chancellor?
First of all, I wrote How to Lose a Country for people who hate politics, people who find politics boring. Personally, I find politics very sexy. So I wanted to sexy up politics. But then, when you talk about reality in stark terms, like in clear terms, people tend to get a little bit depressed, which is quite interesting to me. So after I depressed people all around the world with How to Lose a Country. And whenever I went to speak about the book, and whenever I'm finished, and when there's this lead heavy silence in the room, somebody stood up and asked the same question: so where is hope? For a year, I thought about this question. I thought about what are they asking when they're asking about hope, or what are they asking when they ask about an optimist ending to my talks and so on. And I realized something. It's not the hope we lost, actually. It is the faith. Faith in ourselves, faith in politics, and faith in each other. When I talk about faith, people tend to think that I'm talking about a religious concept. No, I'm not talking about the religious concept. I'm talking about this faith that we lost through decades. Because of what happened in 1980s, since then, because of what happened since then, we lost our faith in democracy, in political mechanisms, both domestic and international. So the question is not what can we say optimistically, or what can we say hopeful? The question is, what can we say to refresh people's faith in themselves as political agents, in each other as a political friend, and in communities, in society, in democracy, and so on. So I went back to religion to think about this. How do we believe in God? What is the starting point of believing in a prophet? It's the miracles, right? some miracles are created, and then we believe in a prophet, and then we believe in a God, and so on. So I thought we should produce miracles. And I think this is a miracle right now happening here. On a Monday morning, when it's really cold, when you could have stayed in bed in Munich, you're coming to listen to a woman, curly hair, who cannot speak German, and who's coming from Turkey, and telling you that, okay, we should do something about this. This is already a miracle. And through these miracles coming together and talking more and refreshing each other's faith, I think we can talk about politics in a different language. That's why I wrote Together as a sequel to How to Lose a Country, a manifesto against the heartless world. I think we lost heart. We don't need hope. We have each other. That's much bigger than hope. And faith can only be refreshed if we promise each other and if we promise ourselves that we are going to do the right thing every day. And when a taxi driver rants about immigrants, or when a far-right guy tells something, we don't just, you know, say, ah, it's okay. We don't have to say anything. No, we have to talk. In every possible situation, we have to talk, and we have to believe in ourselves that our words matter. I think this is what we lost. It's not hope. We lost our belief that words matter, our words matter, and that we are political agents capable of changing the world. All these things started sounding naive to many, too many people. But then it was not our choice to think these words changing the world as naive. It was imposed on us. It is not naive. It is very, very realistic. And unfortunately, our lives depend on it as well now. So this is what we need. Hope is produced, faith is produced, and it depends on us how to do it. And I'm thankful that we are here now doing this with, you know, people coming from all walks of life. You're bringing them together, make them talk to each other. This is such a miraculous thing. People do not do these things. Not enough at all.
And I would add one more thing to that. I think it's a lack of honesty, especially also in politics. I think one of the main reasons why all the established democratic parties are not working right now, from my humble point of views, because we developed into something that I would call like short-term honesty. We are talking about what could work within the next 3 years, 4 years. But talking about migration, there is no migration issue. There's an integration issue. And as long as we are too lazy to make this distinction and to talk about that in all honesty with all the consequences, because we can't just stop migration by closing borders and keeping people out, because what are we doing then in 50 years if certain regions are not livable anymore, if people have to come to other regions? Are we then just saying like, nah, I'm born here, that's my country, so just die outside of Europe? That's no long-term answer. And as long as we don't start being honest about topics like this, I think we will have serious issues, and yeah, this will always lead to more fascist developments.
One thing is important. You can, in fact, perhaps stop immigration by closing down the borders, by, you know, building walls, by killing the people who are trying to come in, which is already happening. And you can stop it. This home, Heimat, can be only yours. But then what kind of people would you be then? not being killed on a border doesn't mean anything if you're on the, you know, doesn't mean that you are not affected just because you are on the other side of the border. It kills you as well in a different way. And this country, more than any other country, knows it perfectly well. You inherited a shame, which is a very complicated matter. And this makes you capable of knowing the pain of others without having to inherit another shame. People hate me when I say this, but I trust Germany. Even though I'm critical of many, many things, especially in the last 2 years, I trust Germany because you are serious people. And I trust this. Everybody makes fun of Germans. Oh, they're serious people. They're this. They're... But when shit hits the fan, they trust Germans. And I trust Germans.
So we can end this with a little homework or first task for today. Think about what kind of human you really want to be. Then we can discuss that during lunch later. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you, Daniel. And thank you, everyone. You've been lovely. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. Did you enjoy the episode? Follow us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you prefer listening to your favorite podcast shows. Forward Thinkers is a 48 Forward podcast produced in the 48 Forward Studios in Munich.